So that there's everybody, whatever they submit, that's part of the objective. You got this now, they objected, first of all, to this idea of being a pagan city. Secondly, they objected specifically to the gymnasium because of the nudity, the idolatry connected with it. The public games, by the way, were held in honor of the gods, so there was a religious objection as well as the nudity. You got this? There was the, what we would call the Olympic Games. These contests were religious festivals, really. And for the straw that broke the camel, that camel's back, was when they demoted a legitimate high priest and put Menelaus, who was a Benjaminite, as high priest. Boy, nine pockets never could figure out why the Jews got so upset, because it didn't seem like a big thing to him. But in religious, there was strong objection to this. For instance, we read, and this is reflected in the Second Maccabees. Let me read this to you. When Seleucus was dead, he had been succeeded by Antiochus, known as Epiphanes. Now, this Seleucus is another term for Antiochus III. He was Seleucus, Antiochus, that had about four different names. Jason, Onias' brother, obtained the high priesthood by corrupt means. He petitioned the king and promised him 360 talents in silver, and so forth. This was before Jason was deposed. The king agreed, as soon as he had seized the high priesthood, Jason made the Jews conform to the Greek way of life. I mean, Second Mac, this is in the Roman Catholic Bible. This is one of the apocryphal books that's in the Roman Catholic Old Testament. He set aside the royal privileges established for the Jews in the agency of John, the father of Eupolemus. Anyway, don't worry about that. He abolished the lawful way of life and introduced practices which were against the law, as the law of Moses. He lost no time in establishing a sports stadium at the foot of the citadel itself. What's the beef? This is a gymnasium. And all that went with it. He made the most outstanding of the young men assume the Greek athlete's hat, which was a wide-brimmed hat. It's been quite a scene to see these fellows participating in the nude with a 10-gallon hat on. Anyway. So Hellenism reached a high point with the introduction of foreign customs to the boundless wickedness of the impious Jason, no true high priest. They didn't like Jason because he was a brother. And you can see, if they call Jason no true high priest, imagine what they call Menelaus. By the way, when Menelaus got in there, the Jews actually took up arms and had war within the city, within the country. As a result, the priests no longer had any enthusiasm for their duties at the altar. Not even the priests, but despised the temple and neglected the sacrifices. And in defiance of the law, they eagerly contributed to the expense of the wrestling school whenever the opening gong called them. And you ring the gong, the wrestling competition, there you go. And even supported it financially. They placed no value on their hereditary dignity, as being Levites, born to the priesthood, but cared above everything for Hellenic honors. Because of this grievous misfortunes beset them. You know, God punished them. One of the themes of 2 Maccabees. And the very men whose way of life they strove after, they tried so hard to imitate, turned out to be their vindictive enemies. This is true. To act profanely against God's law is no light matter, as will become clear in due time. Josephus. Also talks about this. If you enjoy hearing the original, the primary sources on, I think you read the secondary history books a lot. I think it's nice to go back here to read the material that the historians read to write their books, from which they write their books. I'm reading from the standard scholar. If you ever do any research in ancient history, the classics, the scholar's edition of all this is the famous Logan Classical Library. This is the Roman Classical Library. It's a section of Josephus, but the Greek on one side and the English on the other. It's a standard scholarly translation. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the same general period, we read this. Let's see where I'm at here. Yes. About this same time, the high priest Onias, you know who Josephus is? The late first century Greek AD, who's writing history of his own people, for the sake of the Romans, by the way, justifying the existence of the Jews to the Romans. About this same time, the high priest Onias also died, And Antiochus gave the high priesthood to his brother, for the son, actually deposed him before that, but for the son whom Onias had left was still an infant. We shall relate all the facts concerning this son in the proper place. And when the former high priest, Jesus, or Jason, rose against Menelaus, who was appointed after him, the populace was divided between the two, the Tobias being on the side of Menelaus, while the majority of the people supported Jason. What happened? Jason didn't like being thrown out of the high priesthood. So when Menelaus, an illegitimate priest, was put on in the high priesthood, Jason got up a rebellion. Now Jason was not interested. He did not fight this battle on behalf of God. He fought on behalf of Jason. Anyway, but the result was the same. But the majority of the people supported Jason. Why? They liked Jason not particularly, but because they disliked having this illegitimate Benjaminite in the high priesthood. Yet,
why did you appreciate Jason?
Well, because he was not really supposed to be the high priest either. The son of Onias was supposed to be the high priest. See, the Jews had a funny mind. They didn't care what kind of man was on there, as long as he was had the right father.
The reason they started in Jason was line of parents.
No. It was supposed to be a direct line of possible. Since Onias had a son, Jason, even though he was not quite as bad, was not supposed to be the high priest.
Was the high priest at the time of Jesus' death of the line of Aaron, or his Menelaus descendant?
Well, they never had the Aaronic priesthood again. They really should have. This was always a continued debate among the Jews. Was the temple worship right because our high priest is not of the right line? And this is part of the background of the Hebrews, by the way, where he says our high priest is not of Aaron, doesn't have to be to the order of Melchizedek. Solve the whole problem. Anyway, it was hard pressed by him. Menelaus and the Tobias withdrew, going to Antiochus, informed him that they wished to abandon their country's laws and the way of life prescribed by these, and to follow the king's laws and adopt the Greek way of life. Now, they knew, actually, Antiochus was determined. They said this is a good way to get in. Now, see, Menelaus, Antiochus was trying to make this a Greek city. Menelaus was his puppet. And so, what happened was, when Jason and many of the people actually took up arms against Menelaus and his followers, he realized that since he was not able to keep the peace, he would probably lose his office and Antiochus would replace him. But, so what they did, they went to Antiochus and said, you've got to help us, because we're going to promote this Greek way of life the way you do. They probably really didn't want to. They weren't interested in being a group in the Hellenistic way of life. They probably didn't care much one way or the other. They probably just wanted to stay in power. This was their excuse. Accordingly, they petitioned him to permit them to build a gymnasium in Jerusalem. And when he had granted this, they also concealed the circumcision of their private parts in order to be Greeks. Interesting thing that they were, that some of these priests were even participating in the games in the nude, and to appear, and the Greeks did not practice circumcision. And so in order to appear as Greeks, they went through a very painful surgery to, let's call it epispasm, a technical term, to reverse the circumcision, exceedingly painful, so that they could participate and appear as Greeks. That's how far they went. Giving up whatever other national customs they had, they imitated the practices of foreign nations. Period of great shame. And so the battle lines are drawn. You got this? Antiochus with his puppet Menelaus and the high priesthood Antiochus IV, Epimenes, a large faction in Jerusalem determined to find the focal point. The focal point of their objection is Menelaus and the high priesthood and the gymnasium and the Greek way of life in general. Now this is very important. You say, well, why? This isn't the time of Jesus. Well, it is. The background of it, for instance. I'll give you one of the many examples. Well, we understand why Paul would work out of Antioch, if you understand this period. The other important thing, those who represent the traditional or orthodox way of life, as opposed to the Hellenistic way of life, those who were trying to resist this, to overthrow Menelaus, to get rid of the gymnasium, This group of people were called the Hasidim, which means pious. And the Hasidims, the Hasidim, listen to me, get this in your notes, it's probably on the head. The Hasidim were the forerunners of the Pharisees. Out of the Hasidic movement came the Pharisees.
Who were they?
They were the party, the leaders of the party who wanted to hold out the traditional Orthodox Judaism, who wanted to resist this attempt to make Jerusalem a Greek polis or a Greek city.
Leaders of the Jason group?
Well, more or less. They were not the same as Jason. Jason was sort of figurehead. Interesting. Jason was eventually rejected by them, too. But Jason was a troublemaker. Now, a very interesting thing happened. Now that the scene is set, there's bitter dissension. You got this? The Orthodox Jews are fighting the unorthodox Jews, the Hellenistic Jews, those who want to go along with this, led by Menelaus, and they're also hating Antiochus. In AD 170, Antiochus set on a campaign to, he wanted to extend his borders. He was always trying to take over Egypt. Once he got this part, he wanted the rest of it. Never did get it. But because Egypt was exceedingly wealthy. Egypt had gold. Egypt raised a lot of wheat. Egypt was you could always depend upon Egypt for food, because Egypt produced a lot of grain. And the beautiful part about it was that Egypt did not depend upon rainfall for grain. Every year you set your crop by the rising of the Nile. The Nile would rise, would fertilize the flats, you would dig the irrigation channels, you could always depend on it. But if you couldn't get grain anywhere else, you'd get it in Egypt. Unless the famine couldn't wipe everything out. But remember Abraham? Before the days of Joseph, remember Abraham went down into Egypt because of famine. He could buy grain there, but couldn't anywhere else. Now, it wasn't famine days of Joseph, but that was unusual. One of the reasons that the Egyptians had a hard time believing Joseph when he said there's going to be 7 years of famine, that was unusual for Egypt. Well, anyway, Antiochus set out to take Egypt, and there, in 170 B.C., one of the great moments of history, I love this, it's arrogant Antiochus, who, the Epiphanes, the great, who, keep in mind, as a boy, he had spent 12 years in Rome as a hostage, and he knew the Romans, he knew what they could do. His father had been defeated by the Romans when they, being encouraged by Hannibal, tried to invade Greece. He runs the back of the Battle of Magnesia, defeated him, and exacted this great tribute. He gets down to Alexandria, and he's going to take the second stage of the Roman Empire. You got that? Alexandria. And the Roman legate, or envoy, didn't have a big army. The Roman envoy met him. Antiochus had this army. The Roman legate didn't have a big army. Armed guard, and he said to Antiochus, and he walked out to Antiochus outside Alexandria. Great scene. He walks out to him, and he draws a circle around him in the dirt. And he says to him, in the name of Rome, you cannot step out of that circle until you promise to go home. We'll let you off. We'll let you go home. You stay in that circle until you promise to go home. If you step out of that circle before you promise to go home, be war. And Antiochus, he knew who he was dealing with. He was dealing with Rome. And so he promised to go home. He's a good boy. He let him go. He was so mad, humiliated, that on the way back through, he raided Jerusalem, killed a lot of people, raided the temple treasury on his way back to Antioch. And Josephus tells about this. I don't take time to read it. Yeah, I think that's hilarious. Can you imagine him standing out there in the dirt? This circle around him in the dust. And Rome telling him he can't step out of that circle until he promises to go home like a good boy. Yes.
Do you want to desecrate the temple?
Yes. We'll get to that. Now it comes down to, and Jerusalem was in a state of revolt. He sacked Jerusalem on the way home. And by the way, that was in 178 B.C. This is just a footnote. In 168 B.C., that was in 170 B.C.
Then you come back with it in B.C.
2 years later, 168 B.C., at the famous Battle of Pydna, which is right here in Macedonia, on this map, Rome defeated the Macedonians, and for the Battle of Pydna, they'd already made it clear to Antiochus that he better do what they say. The Battle of Pydna, the destruction of the Macedonians, as the historians like to say, in 168 B.C., this is important because, see, Jesus lived and died of the Romans. In 168 B.C., the Mediterranean became a Roman lake. Before, it was not so. See, 2 years before, they had enough influence to keep Antiochus out of Egypt. But in 168, they defeated the Macedonians, and the Syrian Seleucid Empire was never again a great force. It's now Rome. Yes.
Is the Roman and Alexandria the real circle around?
I think it's a little bit. I read it yesterday. Refuted, but I can't say his name. Isn't it good? Personnel.
The Romans, interesting, the Romans always treated Egypt as a special case. Rome had ruled Egypt, they never conquered Egypt.
Because they're considered their breadbasket, or?
Yes. Because the bank and the breadbasket.
Thanks.
So they are. Now, the Romans, Egypt, they didn't have to conquer. They would have if they had to, but Egypt capitulated to the Romans. But it was kind of a gentleman's agreement. That is, they never humiliated the Egyptians. Rome always was administered as a special case. And, because, you see, why is this important? You see, well, remember the Paul shipwreck? He was on a grain ship going where? To Rome. From where?
Egypt.
And so for all of his history, Rome was always very careful to treat Egypt. Rome was saying to Antiochus, keep your hands off.
They covered from that area there, and the Roman period covered the area within. Where did Roman cover?
Well, see this map. This look at the date here, 185 B.C. This is 323 to 185. The period I'm talking about is after this.
Yeah,
in other words, this was the Ptolemies were still. Now note this: the Ptolemies were still the local kings of Egypt, but. Rome exercised ultimate rule, but they, for instance, the most famous Ptolemy of all was who? Cleopatra. And Mark Antony made an alliance with her. We're talking about the famous battle when Antony and Cleopatra made war against Augustus. And they combined their navies. But one Roman faction made the lines of Egypt. So they were, the funny part of it, we often think in terms of either or. Either Egypt was completely free, or you had a Roman governor there. It was neither. They had a modicum of freedom, yet Rome, you know, ultimately had the control. And so the Ptolemies maintained their rule. The Cleopatra is there almost 100 years later. She's still there. I mean, the Ptolemies are still there. She's the queen. But, you see, but any time Rome wanted to, they could have invaded. They didn't want to. Because it was just not good business. It wasn't smart. The Romans were no dummy in that kind of administration. The Romans didn't conquer anybody that didn't have to. They didn't believe in conquering somebody who couldn't rule. And Egypt was like a swamp in something that is. Not geographically or physically, but
Cyrus went to Egypt, and he eventually, it was too big for him, ponderous.
You see, it's for the same reason that, the Romans never could really control this civilization. You see, this civilization, this land,
the
culture there is
old. Deep, strong, hard,
big.
An invading army could go in, conquer the cities. It's one thing to conquer an army, it's something else to rule it. And this, the way of life is too deeply ingrained. That is, in other words, the Romans knew that in order to really rule Egypt, they would have to destroy it. Same thing with the Persians. You got that? You would have to destroy it to rule it. If you destroy it, you can't reduce the lay of the golden egg. So they chose to keep a light rein on them. See? The threat was always there. But they never went in and destroyed each other. So foolish to do so.
If they could have done it. See that there's ancient, there's low, the higher civilization tends to swallow the lower civilization. The older civilization tends to swallow the younger civilization.
And
for instance, Greece had a higher civilization than Rome, as far as culture is concerned. But for, let's say, note this, I put it this way, that the average Gentile citizen of the Roman Empire, he may have wore Roman clothes, he thought he was awesome. He wore Roman boots, his ideas were too, by the time he was Jesus. Well, that's an example. That's a good example of the inability of America to cope with the deal with the Middle East. The problem with the Middle East is that you get people like the Muslims. The reason Israel exists is because the Muslims can't live by each other long enough. They can't get together. You get a group of people from who have not fought each other. Let me talk about the Jews and the Muslims. Let me talk about the Muslims, because the Muslim nation, who have hated each other and fought each other for almost 2,000 years. You sit in Washington and draw all the agreements and all the plans you want to. It doesn't take much time. Too many of them, isn't it? Too long. Ingrained in nature. And I'd like to meet, are you all interested in this? We've been using all this time. Tomorrow, very exciting. We see you at the same time as Friday. We're going to talk about the abomination. I want to meet for just about 1 minute or less with all the members of the Chambers family. And I'll let you learn more from the questions I missed. Is that right? I got a lot of lucky. Number one, when Jesus was born, the great civilization of the East were in their youth and thus were ready for the fresh world you offered by the gospel. If you missed that, you can go out and hang yourself. They were very old, the opposite was true. Number two, Augustus restored to Rome the constitutional rule which he had enjoyed the days of the Republic.
False.
What did he do?
Read it up here.
It's the appearance of constitutional rule, but actually the Senate did not rule it either.
What could rip down on the surface, it seemed like it was the truth.
The owner of Georgia didn't actually
No, it's wrong.
Alan got it right.
That may teach you something about taking a test. Listen, you give yourself, you know, count your question correct, count mine wrong. No. On all these, when you get your paper back, you knew the answer. But I, see, that was the point of the question. Did he or did he not establish constitutional rule of the service? He did. You're right. Underneath, he didn't. But that's not what the question said. But he did not say on the surface. It could be. I'm just saying, John, I'm not jumping on you. But I'm just saying, in general, it's dangerous business. You have to amend the question. You know, put a footnote on it or rewrite it. I worked hard on these questions. Leave me alone. Number three. The age of Augustus was a time of recovered glory for Rome, but it created a social climate which was tragic for the church.
False.
Very good for the church. Later on, that's what people think. The church, by the way, but the persecution of the church did not come from a social climate in Rome. You know, just the general social climate that was more particularized. Number four, Augustus was determined to restore to Rome the ancient tradition which had made her great.
True.
Five, Stoicism was a popular philosophy among Romans because of
C.
offered Heinz and ethics, glorified the virtues of bravery, honor, and number six, part of the gospel overcome the old Roman mythological religion because Augustus had restored the hearts of the people back to the ancient gods.
False.
Now, this had a religious revival. Which of the following authors and his major works glorified the rule of Augustus? Virgil didn't write, by the way, the Ode to the Annals. Horace wrote the Ode and passed it over to the Annals. Marcus Aurelius, what was Marcus Aurelius?
Greek.
That was a story. Right?
Yeah, no, emperor.
Where did he live?
Second century.
He didn't have a word about Augustus. He was a Stoic. We studied his writings because he was a bold Stoic. Talked about the fact that in Palestine, there were Antiochus Epiphanes, that his attempt to Hellenize Palestine in general, Judea, Jerusalem in particular. There was objection to the fact that Menelaus was made the high priest because he was a legitimate high priest. There was objection to the Greek social institutions, particularly the gymnasium. And then the star broke the camel's back when he outlawed the Jewish religion, forbade the circumcision of children. So we call it parents that were found having circumcised their children were often crucified with their cloak to the children strung about their necks. Then the ultimate desecration was the problem. Desecration of the temple offered to sell on the altar. And this led to a revolt led by the house of the Hasmoneans, royal house or Socratic house. Later on, Judas Maccabeus became recognized through the movement. They accomplished what's called the Maccabean Freedom about 165 BC in Russia. The temple was rededicated. We recall it was not absolute freedom. Just simply forced the Seleucid movement into allowing enough freedom to practice their religion. And this situation more or less constantly prevailed for about 97 years, about 300 years, until Rome actually set up active control over the Judean state. That's why when the New Testament opens, it's Rome, or Palestine, Judeans, Galileans, Syrians, Samaria, this area, and under the direct rule of Rome. Okay? Did I get the picture? Yeah, the Seleucid rule established about 200, about the Maccabean rule about 165. There was 100 years of relative freedom in Rome. Yes.
When Rome came in, how did they come in? Did they come in just forcibly fighting? Did they have to fight them completely?
They came in and conquered Jerusalem.
Sure. So I just wanted to show them.
Yeah, when you established direct military. Actually, what they took over the area technically when they finally came out, I think it was about 65 BC, 67 BC, in Antioch.
city of this area. Remember I said that Palestine at this time was considered, was called what? It's called Lower Syria. Remember that? Full of Syria up on the board. And the capital of Antioch up here, of course. And so they hit the capital that actually came in and took the city. Before they could give orders to Antioch, it's done where you go and where you couldn't go. They never actually came in and took over the area. So they took, after this 97 years of what's called the Maccabean Freedom sometimes. Came and took the capital city. Well, Antioch is the capital city of this area. And by the way, you see, later on, even after they, in the youth of Jesus, there was a time when, you see, even when Pilate was governor, which is going to hit ourselves, we'll come back to it. When Pilate was governor, he was responsible for the legate of Syria, for Antioch. He was not king. He was a governor who was responsible in the line of chain of command for the legate of Syria. Roman official above him. So Antioch continued to be the capital city in the rest of this area. In the days of Rome. Consistently true without changes, but as Rome looked at Palestine, Lower Syria. Okay, now
the Macedonian Revolt 155 BC, they forced the Lucians to let them practice the Jewish religion.
Yeah, they forced. They weren't completely afraid, but they forced the Seleucids to back off.
100 years.
Roughly 100
years. Then the
Romans conquered Antioch.
About 67 BC.
Yeah. It's hard to say because they didn't just come in and kind of flag them when Iran would claim rule over an area before they actually took over an area. You see the gradual growing power of Rome. 100 years before this, Rome had enough authority to keep Antioch as the fourth out of Egypt, along the circle of the dust. They didn't have to come in, but they wouldn't take over.
When did the Seleucids actually first have control of this area?
The exact year is 198 BC.
Do I have 200 BC down here?
That's probably my fault. I try to round it off.
Let's find out.
What I wanted to talk about now is, and we're going to come back to this a little bit later, but this is the way, why do you go back this far? Well, you need to understand this, understand the world of the New Testament. And the thing I want to talk about now is the fact that this Maccabean revolt was a revolt not simply against the Seleucids, but it was a revolt against Hellenism. It was a revolt against the attempt to do away with the Jewish religion. Reactions are usually extreme. That is, the old pendulum effect. Usually go too far the other way. And in the broadest possible term, this is what happened. That the Jewish leaders reacted to this attempt to do away with the Jewish religion, to make the gymnasium the center of life in Jerusalem rather than the temple, to do away, to outlaw the circumcision, to outlaw the scriptures. They reacted in an extreme way, and this reaction we see, we have to understand this reaction, to understand, for instance, the religion of the scribes and Pharisees in the New Testament. What they did was, in reacting to Hellenism, the experts say they absolutized the Torah, the
technical word. You don't have to, I'll get to remember it, I'm not going to ask you, I'll tell you. They absolutized the Torah. What's Torah mean? The law. Going back to that, as a part of this reaction, the leaders of the nation, the movement was called, this movement was called the Hasidic movement,
Later, this developed into the rabbinic or the Pharisaic movement.
And we get, we're going to take a class history of biblical interpretation of Bill speaking.
We talked about this. But the what they did was they went back to reestablish the minds of the people, the old path. It was a revival. But the revival that went too far and called people back to the law, they absolutized the Torah. That is, they made the Torah the absolute and only standard of life. Try to make a Palestinian theocracy again in terms of the law, the Torah. Because you see, and three great institutions, three great foundations of Judaism came to the front. There was the Torah, the law, we call it the Pentateuch sometimes. There was the temple. There was the synagogue. Nobody's quite sure when the synagogue actually came into existence. You can say that the synagogue and they just
you couldn't run. You didn't have to say, no, you know, don't put the fire to work. But if he was going, but you couldn't ask him to. Now, if a Jewish child, a minor, came in, you had to tell him to leave the fire alone. Because, you know, because that's not your work.
But it also said, you're on a ship, and it's time to get off the ship. You can't put the gangplank down to walk off the ship. You just have to end up in the water and wade ashore, because that's putting the gangplank down is work. However, if a Gentile puts the gangplank down, you can walk over it. As long as he didn't put it down for you. You know, if he said to you, here, I'll put the gangplank down for you, then you couldn't get it, even though the gangplank down, you had to, you know, dip over the side and swim ashore, because he did it for you. And see, that might be like, even though you didn't work, somebody did it for you, that might break the law. But put the head way out here, so that as long as he didn't know you were going to walk over it, you know, the gangplank was already down, the Gentile didn't know you were going to walk down on it, then you can walk down on it. But if he had you in mind to put the gangplank down, you couldn't use it. Now you see, the mission, the whole thing is the hedge.
The whole thing?
Yeah. The mission, this kind of thing that you come out of the town, they're all the hedge. The mission is the beginning of the primary.
Gemara
is a comment on the mission. Seriously. See, the law is this big, the Torah. The mission is this big. Yeah, it's a comment on the law. And the Gemara, the Talmud of the Mishnah, the Talmud is about 12 lines. That long. Yes.
You call these what they call the rabbinic development.
Yes, rabbinic is the adjective on the fly. Yes.
If they had a hedge around the law, but you couldn't, if you took the law, they'd have to have the law behind those absolute people.
Yes, first they defined the law. And then it couldn't get stopped, so they, that was the Mishnah. And then their commentary was bigger than the law. There was more rules in the Mishnah than there was in the law. Then they couldn't get stopped, and that, because you might not, in the Gemara, I mean, in the Mishnah, there's some things that weren't quite thoroughly interpreted and defined. So the Gemara interpreted the Mishnah, commented on the Mishnah. Very, very interesting. For instance, they ruled that you could, you should chew on peppercorn for their bread or whatever. And they said if you had a piece of peppercorn in your mouth when the sun went down on Friday and the Sabbath began, you could keep it in there. But you couldn't, after the sun went down, you couldn't put a piece of that would be vanity violating the Sabbath. If you had false teeth, had false teeth in the world. If you had on the Sabbath, if you had gold false teeth, you couldn't wear them on the Sabbath because they were vanity. But if you had wooden false teeth, it looked like sin anyway. You could wear those. So that's, you know, that's the chewing. That could be gold, that wooden plate. In other words, you could chew, but you could not enhance your appearance. Your teeth do two things. They have to chew and enhance your appearance. And so the law, what they decided was that it was okay to have teeth to chew on the Sabbath, but not to enhance your appearance. So you could have, and if you're just going to chew, wooden teeth are good enough. So you wear your wooden false teeth on the Sabbath. You had to chew your food, but not your gold teeth.
Right.
Well, anyway, I don't want to get any more time on that. But you see, this is what Jesus was talking about when he said, you have made the law of none effect by your tradition. His tradition was his head. You see, and this is why Jesus, who never broke the law, often stomped down the hedge. Because the law was the word of God and the hedge wasn't. For instance, the disciples were walking along the side of the day, and according to the law, they were taking grain and the law say that you could not square off your field. You had to leave them rounded off to the traveler and the poor person walking along and hungry. They didn't have breakfast every 3 miles in the answer road. No problem traveling. They left grain on the field, and you could, the law said if you're traveling along, you could, as long as you were on the roadbed, you could reach over the grain and get whatever, pick whatever was available. Not the law, you know, if you came over your side of the fence, but you couldn't.
leave the roadway and go and harvest. And it was a Sabbath, so they were walking along and doing this, rolling the grain in their hands. Somebody were condemned to what? We were harvesting. No, they weren't. They didn't break the law. We're eating. But they had decided, what they had decided was, there's no question if you go out in the field and work on the Sabbath, you're breaking the law. But, you see, if you pass a rule that says you can't even roll, you know, some wheat between your business and the farm, you take the wheat, you roll your hands, you blow it with a chaplain, you eat the grain. That's how it was. Well, you know, this walking law, they were harvesting, they were eating, you know, like you can burn. So they said, look, if we outlaw that, see, then we have a man who would never, even if he were hungry, traveling along, you know, on the Sabbath now, reach over and get some grain heads and rub them between his hands and eat them. If he would never do that, it's a sure thing he would never go out in the field and harvest. So we will make the rule that he can't even do that. That'll make sure that he doesn't harvest. You see that? Do you see the theory behind this?
Yes.
Could they even travel on the Sabbath?
Yes, not very far. It depended.
And they had all kinds of silly rules.
And they worked out, and by the way, they had this worked out. Once they got the swing of this, they really got the spirit of it. They worked out all kinds of traditions that enabled you to break the law if you wanted to. By some strange paradox or reversal of theory, some strange. But for instance, Jesus said, by the law you have broken, but you develop one tradition, you develop so many traditions in one connection with one law that you end up breaking another one. What clear example did Jesus give of this?
The Easter ordinance?
Yes. They would dedicate, they would say, it's all dedicated to God, therefore I don't have to do what with it.
You make them mother and father.
And take care of my mother and father. Well, there was this whole system. I don't want to get into that, but I want to see, you have to understand this, understand the Jews of the first century. Now the Pharisees, the Pharisees are the bad guys, you can call somebody a Pharisee, you haven't said something good about them. However, the Pharisees, by Jesus' time, were the proprietors of this system, which had gotten out of hand. But you have to understand that the Pharisees, in their beginnings, in this intertestamental trade, were the good guys. They did save the law, as it were, from the Hellenistic influences. But what I want us to see is that this, which Jesus came up against time and time again, the tradition of the Pharisees. But this was the result, after 100 years or so, of a process that began when the leaders of the Jewish nation in Palestine tried to do what? Tried to say, to resist this trend against Hellenism, and want to destroy the Jewish religion, could. Secondly, to adapt the law to interpret the law so it can be obeyed in a world that was different from the world in which the law was given. We have the same problem today by the New Testament of Jesus. Try to reproduce the first century church. Did the first century church, for instance, meet at 9:30 in the morning for Bible school, 10:30 in the morning worship, sing the doxology 5,000 times a year, and have church buildings and order of worship just the way we do? I nearly thought I listened to my... Oh, you want to go to Christian Center? How did the early church, the first century church, protect the Lord's Supper? When did it protect it?
Last
year. Or the last feast. Wasn't part of what we call the worship service at all, part of the fellowship supper. They've got fellowship supper, and then evening service, or morning service, and all day eating dinner on the ground. If you've been the first century church, when the church began, they took the Lord's Supper with the fellowship supper, not with the singing and the preaching. You know that? Well, point is, and this is the cultural adaptation, but how do you do it, you see? How do you interpret the New Testament, the principles, for the we, in our culture, in our day, it's not like the world of the New Testament. How do we follow the biblical pattern? I'm simply saying here, it's a real problem. So don't picture this Hasidic rabbinic Pharisaic movement as a bad problem. When it started, it was good. They were meeting a real need. They were doing what we would call a good thing. They simply got carried away. They couldn't get stopped.
This has put us in a pretty good idea, but they feel the lawbreaker or the head breaker.
Yes, but they could.
In this case, it would be wrong. It's all right, like you said, it's all right in some cases when they had a head.
Well,
but,
Well, the Hedge principle basically is dangerous. Now, on a personal basis, it's good. I'll give you an example. Now, do you have any guidance for me? Hold up the day, it's good. I like it much more speaking at this time. What's wrong with the principle? Well, when you talk about theological legislation, you might call it, when you start drawing up rules for general conduct, then the Hedge always gets you in trouble. Now, as far as a personal ethic, you simply apply to yourself and to no one else, I think it's very good. For instance, we do something like this. Let me say, if there's, and Paul taught something about this on a personal basis, if I'm not legislating to anybody else. In Romans 14, a little bit of a hedge. That is, if meat causes my brother to stumble, what? I'll not eat meat. Because eating meat is wrong? No, because if I do, there's a possibility I will do damage that's not, and it's not worth it. You know, sometimes the price we pay is not worth the benefit we get.
The, who was it? One of the ancient authors spoke of a man who went fishing with a golden hook. Fishing this all the time. We're fishing with a golden hook. What's wrong with fishing with a golden hook?
You don't need to be fishing.
What?
You need your hook.
Yeah, so I am about the principle.
Yeah, that's it. What you stand to lose is more than what you stand to gain. Fishing the golden hook, you stand to lose what? A golden hook. You stand to gain what? A fish. So what you stand to gain is not worth what you stand to lose. That is the principle. And many Christians overlook the lesson of the golden hook. Often, we participate in all kinds of questionable practices. The questionable compromises, ethical compromises in our life, because it's fun or whatever we want to, not realizing that what we gain by it is not even come close to what we tend to lose by it. That's the principle of the hedge. That is what Paul said. I'm not going to fix the book. In other words, do I like meat?
Yeah.
If you like, you're raised on pork chops, you say it's the dinner. You're raised on pork chops, bacon, all, you know, food. But you see, if you cause your brother to stumble, it really hurts his faith. What you gain by it, which is what? The enjoyment of meat, which is not wrong in and of itself, is more than what you stand to lose by it. What? The brother. So it's kind of a hedge. And so he calls upon people to make this a personal decision. I think a wise Christian does this. A wise Christian will create some hedges in his life. Certainly not, for instance, certain things, I don't want to teach my children to gamble. Therefore, we don't allow playing cards in our house. We play rough and old maid. You say, well, that's not consistent. I know. But I'm not talking to worry about a hedge. It's my hedge. It's my hedge. I'll play where I want it. That's fine. See, so I've got a little hedge. I just don't get my kids used to playing cards. And therefore, I think by this, I'm not into it. I don't need to. You know, you say, well, maybe why not? Christmas and New Year's. Anyway. So, is there anything wrong with that? You see, if I start telling you, Lily, that you can't do it, see, I make you walk around my hedge, then that, and that was the problem with this system. See that? But the idea of the hedge is not bad on a personal basis. I think we ought to build some hedges in our lives. But my family, my head. Since I start making you walk around my head, then you got what you got with the Pharisees.
Well, the bylaws that a lot of the churches have today fall into.
Yes, bylaws are, by and large, hedges. Well, not bylaws, constitutions. Your constitution and bylaws. I got a theory about them. I'm going to church that have constitutions, New Testament. I think I'll have bylaws to state when he calls meetings and what days you meet and what the procedures are. My thing about bylaws is this: the only time bylaws ever get written is when somebody's mad at each other. And I think a church that has an excellent set of bylaws, have a good set of bylaws, have a lawyer draw them up, make sure they're excellent. They'll not be more than 2 pages long. Make one copy, give it to the chairman of the board, he'll lose it. I think I'll be ready for 25 years.
Without fail, every 25 years, don't any longer than go by, read about it, every 25 years. Every generation will hear for us. But this would be an example. And you have head stations, for instance, some churches, if you have somebody beside an elder, pray at the table. You know, you violate the will of God. Not the head. Does the Bible say that? There's a connection between who prays at the table and the eldership in the New Testament. And a lot of us have a connection with that, which is the head building. And people have all kinds of hedges. You know, people have hedges. So, I don't know if this may be interesting to you, but, it is not really off the side, because this is the very thing we see in the New Testament, that Jesus rejected this. He rejected the hedges that the Pharisees, by this time, just couldn't get stopped. And he rejected this thing, and they tried to impose it on other people. Any question? Do you understand what I'm talking about? The Christian won't build some hedges, I think, is stupid. You say, this is your attitude. The Bible doesn't say it's wrong, I can do it. And if I can't find book, chapter, and verse that says it's wrong, then I can do it. If that's your attitude, then you don't have the foggiest notion what Christianity is all about. You need to be converted. You need to be converted from Judaism. Christianity. You need to be converted from law to grace. And I'll be glad to baptize you.
I don't say I can't do this.
Well, the Bible's not written that way. That's not written
that way. If you're going personal ed, you're going to affect other people.
Personal
ed.
Now, I think total absence is a good hedge. But the Bible teaches, absent under no circumstances, you can take it from not take a drink, but say that. However, interesting. What about social drinking? Well, social drinking does not violate any biblical law against what you take in your body. It does violate the biblical ethic of wisdom. But the primary sin of a person who drinks is not drunkenness, it's stupidity. The Bible commands to be wise. Anybody who drinks socially today is a perfect fool. That's necessary to do. No. It tastes good. No, if you mix it with something, so you're going to get stuff down. What if you do wrong job your sweat, you know, walk around taking anesthetics? Complete violation of the Christian ethic. Anybody thinks they can do it, just because violating the biblical command to be wise. Well, so what you do? In other words, what I'm saying is that hedge building, a little personal hedge building, is the wise thing. Very wise. But you can't build somebody else's hedge. Well, and this is what this system was in the simplest terms. And it's very serious because Jesus. It was a center, it was a talking point of much of the opposition to Jesus, which had a big part of the crucifixion. Yes?
What happened so much to know the things that I knew what he did? I know they said, I want to go, I think you should fit this more than you would do this thing, I'll go to
the field. Not necessarily. The only time you walk over something, you're advised, the only time you do something like that in your experience is when you have to, in order to obey the command of God. No business because it's there. Jesus didn't do it. Mission Jesus observed many of the traditions of the Pharisees. Because they didn't make any difference one way or the other. The only way the traditions of the Pharisees kept him from doing the will of God that he tore down the hedge. It wasn't necessary. Well, they couldn't have. Well, right. Good point. There wasn't it wasn't a necessity to be spending and told them, okay, but that's a good point. We had to modify my realization.
The way to spending
it. He was all in what he was doing. He was teaching. He was wrong. He was doing that stuff.
Well, what they had constructed was the system is impossible to keep all. It's impossible to really stay outside the head. It's impossible to do so. And Jesus said that they what did Jesus say? These fellows tie burdens on people's backs that nobody can carry. And the time they got through, it's impossible to get through the day without violating something.
Well, they still take you into the rules.
Yes.
To Phil's question or statement there about they could go hungry with this teaching that from Matthew 15th chapter, Jesus said, told them that Isaiah had prophesied well of them, saying, "You draw near me with your mouth and honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. In vain do you worship me, teaching the doctrine and commandments of men." And I think that's something that we should really think about when we want to teach our own dogmas.
That's right. And Scotty raised a good point. By Jesus' time, see, when they started out, this was recognized as not the law, but the hedge. Got this? But by Jesus' time, they thought the law was out here. That is, in their mind, they came to identify the hedge with the Word of God, the will of God. And this is what Scotty was talking about. That they didn't say, "Well, let's do this so we don't break the law." They were saying, "This is the law." Jesus said, "It isn't." You're teaching for commandments, what? The doctrines of men. Exactly what he's taught. You're teaching as if it were the Word of God, but it isn't. Such a man-made rule.
Isn't the exact same thing now with, the general consensus? Most preachers say that if you smoke cigarettes, if you smoke, you're going to hell. Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah, anybody that says that, because the Bible doesn't say that. But it violates the ethics. For instance, anybody that today who smokes in the light of all that is known about smoking, it's foolish. When I talk to my teenagers about dancing and drinking and smoking, I don't say to them, if you go to one dance, make one cigarette, make one bottle of beer, you're going to hell. I point out this is a very foolish way to live. The Bible commands us to be wise. Now, if you do this to the extreme, then you begin to violate the definite commandments. And against drunkenness, against destruction of the body, against violating your brother's conscience and other things, sex eventually, fornication, because the dance is sexual foreplay. Dancing is nothing more than sexual. I'm a square dancer. Dancing, you ask any expert on the field. I'm talking about Christians. I'm talking about those who know what dancing is. It's sexual foreplay. But the music, there's nothing more than that. Nothing less than that. It's always been that. If you read the experts on it, from the world, and ask them what it is, they'll tell you. I've got the books I can show you. There's no question about it. You see? And they laugh at the Christian who acts like it's something else. Just fun. Or just have a good time. Just fellowship. And the devil, those who really understand that, you know what it's all about, they just laugh their heads off, these foolish Christians. Well, anyway, prisoner is that the very foolish. They're foolish. So, but you see, what you teach it for what it is, not for what it, you don't teach it for a commandment, explicit command on that or against it, it's not there. But you do teach it as it fits into what the Bible does say. Yeah.
If the Mishnah was the heads around the law, anything around about 200 AD, what kind of heads do they have around the law during practice?
Good question. No, the 200 AD represents when it was written. Excellent question. Do you know what somebody asked? If it was written 200 AD, what are we talking about in Jesus' time? Now you see, this, I didn't get into this, and I should have.
This concept, this hedge, if you say to them, where did it come from? That they would say from God. He said, well, it's not in the Bible. Here's how they, what did they say, Gail? Where did this come from? It came from God. Yes. What they taught, now this doctrine was not taught in the beginning. This doctrine sort of grew to justify. What they taught was that when Moses went to Mount Sinai, he received the written law, which we have in the Torah, but then he received another law, which was the oral law. And so by its very nature, the written law was to be passed down in written documents, tablets of stone. The oral law would be passed down word of mouth
obviously, from one generation to the next. And so what they said was, this is the written law, and this is the oral law. Well, by being oral, the Super Council, by being oral, by definition, it would be very slow to write it down. But it was very much known in practice. It was just, you just didn't write it down. It was oral law. Well, this eventually they got around to writing it down. Excellent question. Y'all see what I'm saying? So it was there. It just was not written down in a volume. And this is the reason that it was conceived of as an unwritten law. It's still the law of God. Now, this idea that it was the law of God came along, that was growing about the time of Jesus, and it was already there. Nobody didn't have a committee get up one morning and say, hey, let's start thinking this way. Let's start thinking about the oral law. Let's start looking at it. It didn't happen. It gradually evolved. A long period of time. It began with the Maccabean revolt. You see that? It began as a revival to preserve the law in the minds of the people. And it just simply got carried away. And by the way, this traditionalism, and that story shot me out when I sat a half hour behind that. It's all your fault. This way of thinking, you see this in Roman Catholicism, you see it in all the church, each of the religion, this works this way. But I think if we understand this, it'll help us. For instance, one of the many things our churches need today, we need to get rid of some traditions. If we don't get rid of some hedges pretty soon, we're not the younger, the next generation, the generation coming along, is not going to be reaching the gospel at all. At all.
Ask President Bourne. He's in charge of practical reality. First of all, Katie. But every time I said it, you can't answer that. Yes.
Was it part of the
what?
Shema.
Well, the Shema came to be considered through this period, through all this. It's hard to locate exactly when. Came to be the fundamental statement of Judaism, because they were reacting again to this Hellenism, held many gods. And Mishner, in his book, The Source, tells about this old man who, this is a historical fiction, but it captured the spirit of time, when this community, they gradually passed more and more laws against the Jewish religion. First you couldn't circumcise your children, or then you had to regularly pay homage to the image of Antiochus, but you still go to the synagogue. And then later you couldn't circumcise your children, but you go to the synagogue. And later on you read the law of circumcision. You gradually whittled away, and the people in the community were being, you know, gradually deprived of their faith. And finally, one old man drew the line. He said, no. No. And so the authorities skinned him alive and burned him. And his last words were, Shema Israel, Adonai Ahingalama, Adonai Ephah. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. In Deuteronomy 6:4, that's good. That's right, sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He came, the Shema, he asked to pick up the Shema. The Shema came to be the sort of the. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And so, you see, this came to be the sort of the theme verse for this whole movement, because they're reacting to paganism and said, many gods. This was the thing that set, this was the foremost thing that set apart Israel from paganism. God is one. And the Shema means, in Hebrew, you all know this, the Shema is in Hebrew, this is the word for this word. This is an imperative. This is a imperative verb. It's Shema, which is a commandment. Hear, a commandment, an imperative. Hear, O Israel, the first word in this verse. Shema Israel, hear, O Israel, and it came to be called the Shema. Because it's a simple translation of this word. That word. Is that what you're asking? Hard to pin it down. Mishnah maybe a little bit early, putting it this
far back as Van Hyck, but the feeling in front and part of the movement, as if, you know, they had it. There's something they had no concerns, they don't think they have no in their lifestyle, but as well, no in life, they can do it, they're paid for more. Well, I'm off tomorrow with Harvey.
I think a missionary?
In the Duke of Duke. Well, I thought it was a part of their group. Like, they had no certain, you know, they had no certain things. Like, it was a certain law, certain writings of what the law they had, you know, they had a part of life, knowing that they were going to have to put it on tomorrow. Like, not even, you know, a book, and just had these certain, you know? I can't focus, I can't narrow it down. Well, tomorrow, this is all I've got to say about this. I'm going to get back on the subject tomorrow. We're going to talk about, tomorrow we're going to talk about television. You didn't know this, the Astro. Look at a little outline. Oh, there's one have a copy of the outline of the section. We're going to deal today with Hellenistic Judaism. Not very exciting, but the idea is involved. The thing is important. Hellenistic Judaism. Very critical thing and study of playing the background of the New Testament, the world of the New Testament. There is a term. I think I'm sure this is the term diaspora, dispersion, the book of James is addressed to whom? 12 tribes scattered abroad, or the tribes of the dispersion. Now, we have looked at talked at length about the rabbinic exegesis which developed out of the Maccabean revolt against the attempt to Hellenize Palestine, and it resulted in a form of Judaism often called rabbinic Judaism. Sometimes referred to as Orthodox Judaism, or sometimes referred to as Pharisaic Judaism. The Judaism which was the conservative view, which was extreme Judaism. Most extreme, you see an extreme political expression of these in the Zealots. We're talking tomorrow about the Jewish sect of the Jews. But today I want to talk about how to get through this. Talk about the Jews of the dispersion or Hellenistic Judaism. Now the dispersion began in 722 BC when the Assyrians, the Assyrian Empire, conquered the northern kingdom after it was recorded the death of Solomon. The kingdom divided, and Samaria became the capital of the northern kingdom, or Israel. 722, the Assyrians conquered it and dispersed many of the peoples. And in 586, 585, well, in the year 60, between 606 and 586, the Babylonians conquered the southern kingdom of Judah, the background of Jeremiah, for instance, much of Jeremiah, and dispersed many peoples, took a large number of people over to Mesopotamia, to Babylon, or the Mesopotamian area. But the dispersion continued throughout the days of the empire. For instance, the days of Seleucid, the Hellenistic empires, the Jews continued to be spread abroad for all kinds of reasons. Many fled. Remember when we talked about the fact that Menelaus was put on the throne, a number of Jews down to Egypt. Some Jews were already there. They built a temple at Neapolis, by the way. Of course, the ultimate dispersion came in AD 70, after the end of our period, AD 70, when Titus, remember Jesus said that one would come and Jerusalem would be destroyed and people would fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive into all nations. That was the ultimate of the dispersion, but the dispersion had been going on for several centuries. So that when we look into the New Testament, we find that the Jews are not simply in Palestine, but wherever Paul goes, he goes to the synagogue.
He goes to Ephesus, he goes to the synagogue, first Thessalonians. He goes to Micah, he goes to the synagogue. He goes to Corinth, he goes to the synagogue. Now, in the days of the dispersion, as near as are the days of the New Testament, in the world of the New Testament, as near as can be guessed, there were more Jews in northern Egypt, Alexandria in particular, than there were in Palestine. In the first century. Of the five districts of Alexandria, two of them were Jewish. And there were more Jews in what's called Babylonia, the Mesopotamian Valley, the east, than there were in Palestine. Probably.
I missed who the king was in AD 70, but the ultimate.
Well, Titus, the Roman general, took.
He ordered the pilot.
Yes. Just to the east, then called Babylonia, then the Mesopotamian Valley. And there were Jews throughout the Mediterranean world. They, as far as Rome, there were no Jews in the first century west of Rome. That came later. So they were, and Rome had a heavy Jewish population. So at that time, it's a safe saying that in the days of Jesus, in the days of the apostles, if you took all the Jews out of Rome, and they did it ever so often, took all the slaves out of Rome, you wouldn't have enough people left to get up a bridge game. But, start an argument. Well, there was extreme, but there were, the point is that they really, the slave population, the Jewish population, were more of those than were Romans. You know? More slaves and many of the Jews, I kind of confused because many of the Jews were Roman citizens, but most of them weren't. Paul was a Roman citizen, but he was an exception. It's interesting, you know that when they found out that Paul was a Jew, they assumed that he was not a Roman citizen. Didn't they? That was a natural assumption because very few of those Jews were Roman citizens. Now, this is very important, of course, to say the book of Acts. We meet the Jews of Palestine in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We meet the Jews of the Hellenistic Jews and the Jews of the diaspora in the book of Acts. Now, these are called, there's this thing, Hellenistic Judaism is important because the world of the New Testament was a Hellenistic world. That is, the culture, even though it was ruled by Rome, the culture was Greek for the most part. That is, because of the long tenure of the Hellenistic empires from the days of Alexander the Great down to the rise of Rome, because we spent a number of times. The Greek, for instance, even though in later years Latin became a universal language in the West. Up in the Middle Ages, when Latin was the international language. Not so. Even when Latin was the international language, even the second, third, and fourth centuries after Christ, when Latin was the international language in the West, Greek was still the international language in the East. From Rome East, it was Greek. Of course, the early church fathers wrote in Greek. Up through Nicaea, Tertullian, and others, especially for Paul, developed the Latin literature, but it played second fiddle. And even up to the Middle Ages, Greek still held sway over Latin. So, by the way, these international languages, there have been six international languages in the history of the world. Greek was one. Latin was an international language in medieval Europe. French was an international language, and later on in the 18th century, when Napoleon took Moscow and lost it, even before Napoleon, it was anybody who's in the, for instance, in the court of the Tsars of Russia, the court language, the official language was French.
If you spoke Russian, they look down on you. If you're in Russia. They would look down their nose at you if you spoke Russian. One of the Russian dialects. So spoke French. And by the language, you don't have to go anywhere in the world studying.
Jews are the Jews of the dispersion. That became the
sort of the touchstone of the spread of the early church. Now, concerning this, by the way, if you're interested in the odd read from initial compilers, this is Philo, who was first century Jewish
Alexandrian philosopher.
He wrote this: "For so populous are the Jews that no